When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Welcome to Audiobook Break from Audiophile Magazine. This week we're featuring the Japanese-American Civil Liberties Collection from LA Theater Works. Today, it's an interview with playwright Jeannie Sakata. She talks about her moving play, Hold These Truths.
Hold These Truths is a commanding portrait of Gordon Hirabayashi and his stand against injustice. To give us more insight into his life, let's welcome Jeannie Sakata to LA Theater Works. Her play, Hold These Truths, received rave reviews from The New Yorker and The New York Times, and continues to be staged in new productions around the country. Jeannie is also an accomplished actor and voiceover artist. Her latest role is in the off-Broadway premiere of Do You Feel Anger at the Vineyard Theater. Jeannie Sakata, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hold These Truths began life under a different name. Could you tell us about the play's early history and what you did to research Gordon's life?
Yes, I originally titled this play Dawn's Light, and I titled it that for several reasons. One is that I wanted the title of the play to tie in somehow to our national identity. I wanted it to echo something in our national anthem. And so the phrase Dawn's Early Light, I thought that would capture that idea of a nation that was supposed to stand for freedom and to be a new democratic country, something that was very, very dear to Gordon, the idea of a democracy and the idea of a government of the people, by the people, for the people. And so I titled it Dawn's Light for that reason, and also because Gordon began a really amazing hitchhiking trip at dawn, and it was a hitchhiking trip that was amazing to me because he was actually hitchhiking his way to serve time in a prison camp for refusing to go into a prison camp.
Right. And apparently, as I recall, he got permission from the prison officials to actually take himself to another prison.
Yes, exactly. And I thought, what an amazing metaphor for Gordon's life, the fact that he is deliberately, consciously choosing to go to prison, but he's hitchhiking. He's out there on the open road, physically liberated from the jail time that he had been serving up to that point. And that juxtaposition of his inner spiritual freedom combined with the very harsh fact that he had a criminal conviction that he had to serve prison time for was remarkable to me. And it also conjured up images of something like a Woody Guthrie-like trip through America. And I thought was a great metaphor for his life's journey as well.
So why did you change the name to Hold These Truths?
I did that when we had our off-Broadway premiere in New York in 2012. And it was felt that while the title, Dawn's Light, conjured up a beautiful image, it didn't really tell you what Gordon did in the play. And so it was suggested that I try and find a title that connoted more of an idea of Gordon's action in the play. And some friends and I were brainstorming, and I said, what about something from the Constitution or the Declaration or the Bill of Rights? And sort of the most obvious phrase of those was, we hold these truths. Mm. And a friend of mine, dear friend Zach Berkman, told me that he thought it'd be a great idea to title the play Hold These Truths, just without the we. And when he said that, there was, you know, a bell that went off, a light that went off in my brain. And I thought, that is exactly what Gordon does in the play. He holds on to the truths of his spiritual beliefs as a Quaker and to the principles that are so dear to him as an American citizen, as represented in the Constitution. And he holds on through thick and thin until the end, decades later, when he's finally vindicated.
So I have a question. What was it about? Was it about Gordon and his relationship with the prison officials that led them to trust him? To
there
take himself from one prison to another? I mean, that
yes.
is so unusual.
It is. And I think Gordon was an unusual personality. He had immense charm. He had immense integrity. Even as a young college student, there was something quite humble about Gordon, I think, and at the same time, quite forceful. There was something in Gordon when I met him that was something like a mountain, immovable, and a person of great integrity and conviction. But he was able, I think, and this is a remarkable gift he had, to confront racism in a very creative way. It's not that he was angry about it. He was, but he channeled that anger, as far as I could see, into a creative way to deal with racism. So oftentimes when he was faced with racist situations, he would not demonize the person that was discriminating against him, but try and treat him as a human being and try to reason with him and try to point out why that person's position was wrong. And at the same time, you know, being forceful but respectful. And he won over a lot of people that way. For example, you know, the man you mentioned, the federal attorney that gave him permission to hitchhike all his way to Tucson. He had that effect on people time and time again.
What were his parents like?
I adored his parents. I adored researching his parents. His mother was a devout Christian woman and yet was fiery and feisty, and she was a very accomplished intellectual person. She read everything she could get her hands on, to political journals, to, you know, farming journals, to the Sears catalog that's mentioned in the play, and Gone with the Wind in Japanese translation. The family saw her as a genius, but at the time, Japanese immigrant women could not really show that genius because, you know, they were supposed to have the secondary place in society, you know, giving deference to the men. And so she had to show that intellectual gift and that creativity in ways that would not threaten that social order. And Gordon's father was kind of... He was the perfect balance, it seems, to his mom. He was a man of the earth. He loved farming. He loved the outdoors, the sunshine. He was a man of great principle and, you know, as honest as the day was long. And he was the good-hearted anchor of the family.
Why did they come to America?
I believe they came to America for the same reasons that many Issei immigrants, Issei meaning first generation Japanese who were born in Japan and came to this country, very much like my grandparents, they were in search of better opportunities. If you were born, you know, in the lower class status in Japan, there wasn't much hope for you to transcend that status or that class. And around the turn of the century, there were many, many young Japanese men who had dreams of coming to America and making their fortune, or at least earning a better living than what they could hope for in Japan.
What kind of prejudice and legal obstacles did his family face, even after becoming full-fledged American citizens?
Gordon's parents were of the Issei generation, which means Japanese immigrants born in Japan and who came to the States. But When they came to the States, the Issei were forbidden by law to become American citizens. Their children, Gordon and his brothers and sisters, and like my parents, became American citizens through being born in the States. So there was a divide between the Issei and the Nisei in the sense that, you know, they had their citizenship, the Nisei. And because their parents could not become American citizens, many of the Nisei treasured their American citizenship all the more. Knowing what their parents had experienced in Japan, the Nisei children were excited to be Americans, and they considered themselves full-fledged Americans. And yet, they had a kind of a schizophrenia, as Gordon described it, that they went through their daily life proud of being Americans, and at the same time daily encountering the racism and prejudices that society had against Japanese at the time. For example, there were many signs in the windows that African Americans later faced in the South. And I shouldn't say later, but, you know, throughout their lives faced in the South. No Japs welcome here. No Japs welcome in this restaurant or a swimming pool or a movie theater.
And this is before the war. This is even.
Oh, yes.
This was even before the war.
Oh, yes. Way before the war. Yeah. And their parents experienced it, too, in the form legally of alien land laws, for example, which forbid Japanese immigrants from owning land.
Was there anything in Gordon's upbringing that inspired his fight for civil rights and his respect for the Constitution?
Well, as I said, many of the Nisei, including Gordon, really treasured their American citizenship. And when they studied the Constitution in school, Gordon said he just ate it up, were his exact words. He said, you know, he's reading everything in the Constitution and just drinking it up and saying, this is mine as an American. And he took it very much to heart, even as a child, when he first studied about the Constitution in school. And I think that his upbringing from his parents really inspired him to take the stand he did, too, because they were of a religious sect called the Myokokai. And so they were, you know, unusual in the sense that this was a Christian sect in Japan that was pacifistic and democratic, much like the Quakers. And so they were cut from a different kind of cloth religiously. And they inspired Gordon to be a man of principle, to stand up for his beliefs. And he became a Quaker when he was in college. And all those influences, he said, were a factor in his deciding to stand up for his rights as an American citizen.
Why do you think he was so convinced that the government would never abridge his rights as a citizen?
Well, what Gordon told me was that, you know, as a student studying the Constitution, he said, there it is in black and white in the Fifth Amendment. No person shall be deprived of life or liberty without due process of the law. He felt that the Supreme Court could not refuse him as guardians of the United States Constitution. And of course, because he was a student in his early 20s, he was perhaps, you know, a bit naive, but hugely idealistic, and treasuring his American citizenship the way he did, he was absolutely convinced, he told me, that he had an open and shut case. He thought that the lower courts, he felt like, okay, they've ruled against me, but the Supreme Court, as guardians of the Constitution, will side with me.
We have heard about his experience in Tucson Federal Prison in your play. Were there other activists and conscientious objectors in prison with him?
Yes, this is very interesting. There were Hopi Indians in that same prison camp. They were there as conscientious objectors to the war, and they had a great sympathy for Gordon when he entered the camp, because many of them had been mistaken for being Japanese around that area and had been harassed and picked up, even jailed by the police, because they thought they were Japanese. And there were also Caucasian conscientious objectors in that camp as well, who tried to befriend the Hopi Indian conscientious objectors, but the Hopis very mistrustful of them and didn't want anything to do with them, Gordon said. But when Gordon came into the camp, they immediately welcomed him because they were in great sympathy with him and because they understood what he was going through and they identified with him because of the similar experiences of racial discrimination.
Did Gordon and Fred Korematsu know each other?
They did not. Gordon and Fred Korematsu only met years later when their cases were being taken back into the courts after decades, after their criminal convictions in the 1940s. And along with Min Yasui, the three of them met, I think, at a press conference when the attorneys, this third generation, my generation, Sansei, Japanese Americans, these attorneys were volunteering their time to try and take these cases back into the court to overturn their criminal convictions.
And this is in the 80s. This is in the 80s.
Yes. Yeah. And I believe they met at a press conference or right before the press conference. They were together. And there's some delightful footage of that somewhere.
After Gordon was finally released from prison, what were some of the obstacles he faced because of his heritage and his beliefs?
Well, I think that Gordon faced what any of the second generation Nisei faced when they got out of the camps. The war was over, and yet, of course, that didn't mean that the hostilities and racism against Japanese Americans and their parents were over. You know, many of them, when Gordon's parents tried to take up life again after the camp, all of their possessions had been taken. They had to start all over with a boarding house that they established for people coming back from the camps. And Gordon had great hopes that he could study sociology, get his PhD in sociology, but he anticipated that he would encounter racist barriers, so he toyed with other ideas, including becoming a baker, because he had some baking experience in the prison camp in Tucson. But he was very stubborn, very persistent individual. He managed to navigate his way around those barriers, and he did become a professor of sociology, and he got a job teaching overseas in Lebanon and Egypt, which was perfect, I think, for Gordon, because he was always curious about other cultures. He loved to travel. He was thrilled to go abroad after years of confinement. And so that's where he started his career.
And did he eventually come back to the States?
He did. He started his family over there. He had three children, twin girls and a boy. And then he came back. He had two job offers in the United States. One, he said, was in Arizona, and the other was Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. And he told me that he took the job in Edmonton because he would be heading up a new sociology department. And the idea of sort of pioneering the studies in that department and having a stronger say in what would actually be taught was enormously appealing to his sense of adventure. And so he took the job in Edmonton, intending, he said, to eventually make his way back into the States. But then he had his children there going to school, and they had their friends and their community, and he just ended up staying there. Uh-huh. Although he came back to the States frequently to visit friends and family.
In the play, it's a bittersweet day when Gordon finally gets his original conviction overturned in the 80s. How do you think the decision to vacate his original conviction and his posthumous Presidential Medal of Freedom has inspired civil rights struggles in America?
Well, I know that that day was a tremendously redemptive and powerful day for the Japanese American community. I say from personal experience that the Nisei generation, my parents' generation, for many years could not talk about the camp experience. They were youngsters or in high school when it happened. My father was in high school, and it was such a painful, traumatic experience that they stayed silent for many years. They wouldn't even talk to us about it, their children. Fred Korematsu's daughter, Karen, only found out about her father's story when it was covered in her class. And she went home and asked her father, "Fred Korematsu, is that you?" And he said, "Yes." That's how deeply they tried to bury it. And I think when Gordon and Fred and Min were vindicated decades later, it gave the Japanese-American community a tremendous voice, not only for their own struggles and their own stories, but also to stand up for other communities who would in the future experience similar racism and similar discriminatory experiences. For example, when 9/11 happened, there were many in the Japanese American community that were reaching out to the Muslim American community because they understood the backlash that they were experiencing. And just last week, I read a very moving story about how Japanese Americans who were imprisoned in Crystal City, Texas, journeyed there to protest the immigrant detention facility that was very close to the Texas border. And they said, we understand what these families are going through because they use the same arguments against us during World War II. So I think that really empowered the Japanese American community and in a larger way, the Asian American community encouraged them to really use their voices on behalf of other groups who were experiencing racism like they did.
You have staged Hold These Truths all over the U.S. If you had to guess how many people who came to see it knew about Gordon Hirabayashi beforehand, what would you say?
I would say that, like me, very few know about the specifics of Gordon's story. A lot of them have never heard of Gordon. Some of them have heard his name, but only have a vague idea of what his story was. And I get this reaction over and over when people watch the play, and that is, why don't we know about Gordon's story, and why isn't it in our history books? I'm from a thriving Japanese-American community in Watsonville, California, in the Bay Area, and I was stunned when I first learned about Gordon's story from a PBS documentary called A Personal Matter by my friend John DeGraff, that I had never heard this story before. And I had studied at UCLA. I'd had Asian American studies classes. And yet the specifics of this story were entirely new to me. So it's been really gratifying to see people across the country of all different ages and of all different ethnic backgrounds experience the power of Gordon's story the way I did when I first heard about it. It's been a really thrilling experience.
Do you have another inspiring historical subject in mind for your next play?
Yes. I would very much like to tell the story of a very special woman whom I mention at the end of Hold These Truths. She is a Nisei woman named Aiko Herzig Yoshinaga. And Aiko was a high school teenager when the orders came out for all people of Japanese ancestry to go into these barbed wire camps. And so she was imprisoned. And the experience so stayed with her into her adult years that she became a researcher in the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., and taught herself to recognize and to analyze government documents that pertained to the mass incarceration of Japanese Americans on the West Coast. So decades later, Aiko discovered a crucial document called the Final Report that was authored by General John DeWitt. And this final report proved to be key evidence in the trials of Gordon and Fred and Min when they took their cases back into the courts in the 1980s and eventually won the vacation of their criminal convictions. And this document proved that the motivation behind this mass incarceration was racist and not pertaining to military necessity, which was argued at the Supreme Court in the 1940s. So Aiko had discovered this document, and I thought it was a remarkable moment that needed to be told because, you know, as we know today, there is a great cover-up going on in our government now of crucial evidence and crucial documents that, for example, the Mueller report that our American public needs to see, and yet our government officials are trying to hide them from us. And this is exactly what happened in World War II, and I love Eichel's story and very much want to tell it.
And you're going to tell it for LA Theater Works.
I am. And it's a great honor and thrill to be able to do that. Thank you, Susan.
Well, we are very much looking forward to it. I can't wait to read the first draft.
I can't wait to write it.
So at this point in your very distinguished career, would you rather devote more time to writing or acting or something else?
Well, it's interesting. After the response to Hold These Truths, I toyed with that idea of moving on from acting and really just trying to develop other stories from the Asian American community. But doing the last two plays I've done, I did Othello at A Noise Within in Pasadena, directed by Jessica Kobzanski, who was the original director of Hold These Truths, and doing the play that I'm doing now here in New York, Do You Feel Anger at the Vineyard. I realized that I really cannot give up acting. I love storytelling on stage. I love the reactions of the live audience. I love developing new work or making, you know, quote unquote, old work, telling it with a fresh voice. So I think I'll be acting probably till the day I die and also telling stories as a writer until the day I die if I'm fortunate enough to be able to continue both.
And I assume that one feeds the other.
It does. It's very interesting. I think that for me, they come out of different parts of the body, different parts of the brain. And I used to find it difficult to do both at once, but I'm finding it easier now. I think I trust the process of both more, and they do feed each other. I think I'm a better actor for having written a play, and I think I'm a better writer for having been an actor.
And on that note, Jeannie Sakata, thank you so much for joining us today on LA Theater Works.
Oh, thank you, Susan. I'm thrilled and honored to be working with all of you at LA Theater Works. Thank you.
That's the end of today's audiobook break. You've been listening to the Japanese American Civil Liberties Collection from LA Theater Works. It's one of the many excellent audio theater productions available at LA Theater Works. Visit latw.org for more information. Our music is All Our Yesterdays by Mark Niedvich. This has been Audiobook Break from Audiophile Magazine. Thanks for listening.